Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking your sources and really focusing on a huge part of Canada's economy and social fabric that, well, often flies under the radar in tech discussions, nonprofit organizations.
It's true. They're like this invisible pillar, and you might not realize the sheer scale. We're talking about a major employer, a real economic driver.
Give us a sense of that scale.
Okay, well, just look at British Columbia. Over 31,000 NPOs there. They employ more than 11% of the province's entire workforce.
11%. That's significant.
It is. And nationally, the sector contributes about 8.2% to Canada's GDP. That was the 2022 data. So, yeah, not small potatoes at all.
And the really critical thing here, based on the sources, is the demand. It isn't just steady. It's, well, it's surging, right?
Exploding is maybe not too strong a word. The data is pretty stark. Right now, 1 in 5 Canadians uses services from an NPO or a charity.
Okay, 1 in 5.
But here's the kicker. Almost 70% of those people, they're accessing these services for the very first time.
70% are new users.
Ah.
So demand is just spiking.
Exactly. And the sector is scrambling, really, just trying to keep up.
So our focus today, digging into these sources, is to figure out why capacity isn't keeping pace, specifically through the lens of technology adoption.
Right. And we're not talking about the big national charities with huge budgets.
No, we're drilling down.
We're looking at the small NPOs. The ones with maybe 10 staff or fewer.
And they're the majority.
Oh, yeah. They make up over 75%, three quarters of all NPOs in Canada.
Okay, so if they can't get the digital tools they need to be efficient, the whole system starts to wobble.
That's the core of it. Our mission here is to unpack the unique mix of financial, staffing, and even regulatory roadblocks that are holding these vital organizations back.
Let's start where it always seems to start. Money. Funding. But it's not just about not having enough cash, is it? It's how the money comes in.
It's all about dependence, really. For most of these smaller NPOs, over 70% of them, individual donations are their biggest single source of income.
Individual donors.
Yeah, supplemented by government grants, maybe some membership fees.
And those donations often come with, well, strings attached. Or maybe a misunderstanding about what good operations look like. This gets us to the overhead stigma.
Bingo. That's probably the single biggest structural barrier they face. Donors, and this includes government agencies too, they often insist their money goes straight to program delivery.
We want to see it helping people directly.
Right, like 90 cents or more of every dollar going straight to the beneficiary. Which sounds good, but it forces NPOs to drastically limit spending on anything seen as admin or, crucially, long-term investments like technology.
How tight are those restrictions in practice? It sounds almost impossible to run a modern organization that way.
It basically is. You know, private donors might cap overhead at just 5 or 10% of the total grant.
5%?
Yeah. So think about what that means. The sources show 43% of these organizations genuinely believe their funders do not want them investing in technology.
Wait, that's self-defeating, though, isn't it? If I donate $100 for, say, a food bank, and they need $5 for software to track clients securely, I'm essentially forcing them to pretend that $5 bought extra food.
You've absolutely nailed the paradox. They become masters of, let's call it, creative accounting. If they can't justify a new server or a cloud subscription or even basic security software, they hide it.
How?
Well, the sources say nearly 60% of NPOs don't list tech expenses separately.
Yeah, where does it go?
Buried, often under things like office supplies or just general overhead.
Making their books less transparent just to get essential tools. What happens if a funder actually looks closely at that huge office supplies bill?
It creates huge risks, lack of transparency, potential audit problems.
Uh-huh.
It makes the NPO look opaque, even though they're just trying to meet impossible demands. They end up sacrificing long-term health for short-term survival.
In this financial choke point, it must directly impact who they can actually hire.
Absolutely. It leads straight into the next big challenge, staffing.
Right. If you can only spend 10%, maybe less, on overhead,
yeah,
you just can't offer competitive salaries.
The numbers are pretty sobering. Technical workers in nonprofits, on average, they earn 33% less than they would in the for-profit world.
A third less. Wow.
And even non-technical staff, they're earning about 27% less. It's incredibly hard to attract and keep qualified people when the pay gap is that big.
So it's not just being slightly less competitive. It's a major financial hit to choose working for the mission.
Exactly. And the result is scarcity. Only 0.8% less than 1% of the entire nonprofit workforce are classified as technical workers.
And in the for-profit sector?
That's around 5%. Big difference.
Huge.
And for those small MPOs we're focused on, the ones with 10 or fewer staff, having a dedicated paid tech person is basically a luxury. Only 13% have one.
So if they can't afford paid tech staff, they lean on volunteers.
Heavily. Nearly half of these small NPOs rely on up to 20 volunteers, which sounds great, very mission-driven.
But there's a catch, the volunteer trap.
Yeah, volunteers are amazing, you're driven by the cause, but they often don't have the specific professional tech skills needed for, say, database security or network management.
Right, it's specialized work.
It is, and maybe more importantly, volunteers often lack the long-term commitment or, frankly, the same level of accountability as paid staff. This just feeds the high turnover rate that already plagues the sector.
And high turnover isn't just inconvenient, is it? It means knowledge walks out the door. Processes get broken. Data might get lost or compromised.
Organizational memory just evaporates. There's a really telling example in the sources from a housing organization.
Yeah.
It perfectly illustrates the kind of chaos that happens with these under-resourced systems.
What happened there? What did that fragmentation look like?
Well, they had a temporary consultant helping out who then disappeared. The remaining staff suddenly realized their crucial volunteer information, who does what, contact logs, training records, it was scattered across six different places.
Six? Like what?
Oh, you know the classics. Actual paper forms in filing cabinets, multiple different Excel sheets saved on various people's computers, and the real nonprofit staple, an old, outdated Microsoft Access database.
Oh, boy. An Access database. So six systems, none talking to each other, I assume?
Not a chance. So a potential volunteer might inquire, but the information needed to actually follow up or even confirm the request was received, it often just got lost in the shuffle before anything could happen.
Just vanished into the ether between systems.
Exactly. That little story perfectly sums up what happens when you rely on these disconnected, underfunded patchwork solutions instead of cohesive technology.
That really drives home the human cost, the inefficiency cost,
yeah.
That technical debt. Okay, moving on. There's a third layer here. MPOs face external challenges, too, things like regulations that are made worse by the money and staffing issues.
Yeah, this is where their specific mission sometimes works against them technologically. Many MPOs, especially those in social services, deal with really vulnerable people.
Right. So privacy and reporting rules are intense.
Incredibly stringent. Think about the rules set by, like, the Ministry of Children and Family Development or health authorities like Vancouver Coastal Health.
So even tiny organizations might have to meet the absolute highest standards for data privacy just to get funding or operate legally.
That's often the case. If you're providing confidential services, you generally have to adhere to the toughest privacy regulations out there.
Which must limit their options for software, right? They can't just grab the cheapest off-the-shelf tool.
Exactly. It pushes them towards more expensive, complex, maybe custom-built solutions, or at least software specifically vetted for those high privacy standards, much harder to find and afford.
And the irony, according to the sources, is that this complexity often forces them to duplicate their efforts, right? Different funders wanting reports in different formats.
Yes. It's like institutionalized inefficiency. They end up maintaining separate databases or reporting systems just to satisfy various funders or agencies instead of having one streamlined, efficient system.
Adding inefficiency on top of everything else. And then there's this part I found genuinely baffling. Funders sometimes explicitly forbid spending money on necessary tech, these ineligible expenses.
It sounds bizarre, doesn't it? But it's real. We know getting tech funding is hard, but some costs are just flat out disallowed by certain funders.
Like what? What can't they spend money on?
Okay, get this. 14% of NPOs reported that basic hardware, computers, printers, network gear is not an eligible expense under some of their funding agreements.
They can't buy a computer. How?
And it gets worse. 20%, 1 in 5, report that essential software subscriptions, things like secure cloud services or accounting software, are also ineligible.
What's the logic there? Is it outdated rules? Or is it this extreme overhead is evil philosophy?
Yeah.
Why would a funder ban buying a laptop needed to deliver the service they're funding?
It's often a mix. Sometimes it's old policies that treat capital purchases differently. Other times, yes, it's that donor pressure to drive overhead down to practically zero based on an outdated view of efficiency.
But the result is the same.
The result is they're told, be efficient, use tech, but also You can't spend money on the tools you need to be efficient. So they end up running ancient equipment until it literally dies, creating constant crises.
Okay, so the funding model is fundamentally broken in many ways. They can't just fix that overnight. So how do they try to cope? What are the workarounds, the mitigation strategies?
Well, the most common approach tried by 62% of organizations is trying to train their existing staff. Turn non-technical people into part-time tech gurus.
Which loops right back to the cost problem, I imagine. Training isn't cheap.
Exactly. Even when they try, 44% say the cost of good training is a major barrier, and 38% just struggle to find suitable free training that actually meets their specific needs, especially around those complex regulations.
So training is tough. Hiring new skilled people is often too expensive.
Right. 47% say they just can't meet salary expectations.
Which leads to this phenomenon you mentioned earlier, the accidental techie.
Oh, yes. This is such a key insight into how the sector survives, but also why it struggles. Among those smaller MPOs, the ones with under $1 million in revenue, 53%, more than half, rely on someone already on staff who manages tech basically off the side of their desks.
So it's not their actual job?
Nope. They just happen to be the person who knew slightly more about computers or was willing to try, and so all the tech responsibilities just landed on them.
That sounds like a recipe for burnout. And mistakes.
Yeah.
They're doing critical IT work without formal training, probably no budget authority, while also trying to do their actual job.
Precisely. It's completely unsustainable. They lack the training, the time, the budget, the authority. It's an impossible situation, and it definitely contributes to staff turnover.
So when the accidental techie gets overwhelmed or leaves, what then? Do they hire outside help?
Sometimes. About 65% use outside contractors or consultants for specific projects, but there's a real trust issue there.
Trust.
Well, given how cost-sensitive they are, maybe it's not surprising. Only 15% of the MPOs surveyed felt that tech providers were fully trustworthy. Almost half saw them as only somewhat trustworthy.
That suggests some bad past experiences, maybe. Overpriced projects, solutions that didn't work, concerns about data privacy with outsiders.
Likely all of the above. Handing over sensitive client data to a temporary contractor is a big deal, especially with those strict privacy rules.
Okay, and the last resort seems to be finding skilled volunteers for tech roles.
Right. The ultimate trade-off. You get the skills, hopefully without the salary cost.
But it's risky.
Very risky. Relying on volunteers for crucial things like cybersecurity or database management, especially with vulnerable client data involved, it brings serious potential security and privacy headaches. And accountability is weak. The sources specifically mention there's often no recourse if volunteers fail to perform expected tasks.
So if your volunteer database admin just ghosts you, you're stuck.
Pretty much. You're left completely vulnerable.
Okay, so let's step back. If we connect all these pieces, the funding restrictions, the salary gap, driving staffing shortages, the complex regulations, the reliance on accidental techies and risky volunteer setups, what's the big picture? What's the cycle here?
It's a classic vicious cycle, really. Tight financial restrictions, especially the overhead stigma, lead directly to staffing shortages and low internal tech skills.
Right.
That low capacity makes it almost impossible to plan for, justify, implement, or even maintain modern digital tools effectively.
Which leads to
fragmented systems, inefficient processes, burnout. Basically, service delivery that struggles to keep up with that surging demand we talked about at the beginning. The system, as it's currently funded and structured, almost seems designed to hinder technological progress.
And there's one more wrinkle, right? The data we even have about these problems might be masking the true extent of the issue for some NPOs.
Yeah.
The sources called it diluted.
That's a really important point. The available data often lumps all NPOs together. It treats, say, a huge international aid organization the same as a tiny local sports club or a small arts group.
Even though their needs, their funding, their regulations are completely different.
Radically different. Mm. A food bank dealing with sensitive client data and complex logistics has vastly different tech needs and pressures than, say, a community choir. But the aggregated data averages it all out.
So it hides the specific acute pain points felt by organizations delivering essential services.
Exactly. It prevents us from seeing the true depth of the crisis for those working with the most vulnerable populations. Plus, there's the issue of registered charities versus non-registered NPOs. The non-registered ones are much harder to even count or survey, so the full picture is likely even tougher than the current data suggests.
Which means if we really want to find solutions, we can't keep using this broad brush approach.
We absolutely need to segment the data. We have to stop treating nonprofit as a single category.
The challenges facing that domestic violence shelter are fundamentally different from the challenges facing the amateur theater group.
Completely different. Future progress really depends on tailoring support, financial, technical, based on the actual mission and the sensitivity of the work being done.
Which really leaves us with a provocative question for you, the listener, to think about. Given that the technology, the funding needs, and the regulatory burdens are so vastly different for, say, an organization providing essential mental health services versus one running a hobby club, should we fundamentally rethink how support is provided? Should funding, tech assistance programs, maybe even regulations, be tiered or segmented based on the MPO's core mission, perhaps distinguishing between essential human services and other types of community groups to ensure that the organizations facing the most critical challenges get the targeted help they so desperately need?
That's the crucial question, isn't it, for policymakers, for funders, for anyone who cares about strengthening this vital sector. How do we fix that broken model?
Something to mull over after this deep dive.